Good evening, and welcome to the London School of Economics, Rerum Cognoscere Causas. There's a smile, at least one smile in the audience. My name is Tim Frost. I am an emeritus governor here at the school, and like our speaker this evening, I am an alumnus of the LSE. But before I introduce Professor Before I introduce Professor Tews and welcome him home, a little housekeeping. There is no scheduled fire alarm. If it rings, please exit in an orderly and dependent, spontaneous way through the doors marked. Please be sure to put your mobile phones on silent. For tweeters, the hashtag for tonight's event is hashtag LSE2s, which you can see up there.
Sorry.
Is that okay?
makes me laugh.
Good. The school will endeavour to record the event, and a podcast will be made available if all goes to plan. Now, it is my great pleasure to introduce Professor Tews. Before he came to study here at the home of Hayek, Adam studied at King's College, Cambridge, the home of Keynes, and at the Free University of Berlin. A good preparation, perhaps, for seeing at least two sides of the economic argument. He is now the Catherine and Shelby Cullum Davis Professor of History at Columbia University. Congratulations to Columbia. Adam is going to talk to us tonight about his new book, Crashed, How a Decade of Financial Crises Changed the World. And for the podcast, I am now waving my own well-thumbed copy in the air. For those of you who don't yet have a copy, Adam's book will be on sale outside the Old Theatre when you leave, and Adam has agreed to tarry here a while and sign copies should you so wish. Like some of you, I lived through the events described in Crash and was a participant in some of them. Reading Adam's book has given me a fresh and stimulating insight, and what is more, it's a jolly good read. For once in my life, I will quote from the New Statesman. Crashed is already being described as a landmark work, unquote. Adam will wax lyrical for 30 to 40 minutes, and then he has kindly agreed to answer questions. Please join me in welcoming Adam back to the LSE.
Thank you very much, Tim. It's a pleasure to be back here. Let me just make sure that we've got tech. So it really is a pleasure to be here, and thank you for turning out in such numbers. I'm going through a, for me, totally unfamiliar process right now of a mild media storm. I thought this evening I would reflect on some of the questions that I've been almost continuously asked in the last couple of weeks in the process of launching this book. And one question in particular, can I adjust this? Do I need to adjust this mic? Am I good anyway? Okay, fine, can move freely. So the first question I'm asked incessantly, and particularly on the American side of the pond, is did the crisis cause Trump Brexit? So it's really a question about the consequences of the crisis. And the other question that I'm incessantly asked is will it or when will it happen again? And these are the two questions which have dominated all of the media work that I've been doing over the last two or three weeks. And you'll forgive me if I bracket the first question. I'm sure it'll come up in discussion. I'll be very happy to answer questions about it. But I want to focus on the second question. Not because I want to be a prophet this evening, but rather the reverse. I want to think about what it means to be asking this question at all. What, in fact, the it in that is. Because one of the things I find puzzling about the conversations I've been having is that people aren't asking me what happened in 2008. What was the crisis? And yet the question of whether it will happen again, of course, depends on what you think that thing is. And what I'm trying to get at here, and what will be the emphasis, the kind of monotonous emphasis of the next 20 minutes, half hour, 40 minutes if necessary, is just how singular and radical this event of 2008 was. And so in a way, how flummoxing this question is of will this singular and radical event recur anytime soon? And the confusions which seem to me to be endemic in that thinking about 2008 as the sort of event that comes round every 7 to 8 years, like a cyclical recession. And that's really going to be my theme. The theme is going to be how radical this event was. And you have to go back to 2008 and the the great interpreter, analyst, and actor, intervener of the crisis of 2008, Ben Bernanke, I think to get a flavour of quite how radical it seemed in Washington in those vital days in September 2008. Two of the most famous quotes that came out of the crisis, these ones here. If we don't do this, we may not have an economy on Monday. The idea really of an apocalyptic meltdown of the American economy with which Bernanke terrified Congress on the way to the initially failed effort to get TARP through on the 18th of September. And then Bernanke in historian mode, and I think we should take him very seriously, I think this is really the great riff of today's half hour, is September and October 2008 was the worst financial crisis in global history, including the Great Depression. I think what we should take him to mean charitably is it looked like it was going to be, and so very radical things needed to be done to prevent that from happening. And I'm going to spend a good part of my time really driving that point home. Part, I think, of the problem for the American elite of digesting what was happening to them at that moment was that they had, in fact, or at least some of them, had been anticipating a nightmare scenario. It just wasn't the scenario they'd anticipated. The one that they'd anticipated was driven by this kind of story. It was the twin deficit story, the story of the feckless Bush administration, its disastrously ill-conceived geopolitics, the war in Iraq, which was so reminiscent of Vietnam. Vietnam was really reminiscent of the budget deficits of the 1960s, and we know where they led. Those resulted in a huge balance of payments problem for the United States, which blew Bretton Woods up in the early 1970s, and here is America's trade balance with China. And what is it that the Chinese are investing that money in? Well, they're buying US treasuries. And so in this triplicate of graphs, you have this very compact, highly political, not to say partisan, diagnosis of America's situation, of its macroeconomy, of its disastrously difficult geopolitical situation, handing financial leverage to the Chinese as China emerges as a geopolitical contender at a moment of deep embarrassment for the United States. This is the crisis that was expected. This is the one that Paul Krugman, people at the Peterson Institute, Council of Foreign Relations were endlessly harping on in this period. And it has, as Larry Summers described it, the logic that is familiar from the Cold War, the logic of financial terror, the balance of financial terror, a vision of mutually assured destruction unleashed on the one hand by the potential of the Chinese selling off their government their holdings of US treasuries, collapsing the dollar, driving American yields sky high, and on the other hand, of course, the risk that the Chinese would thereby lose their market and do serious damage to their export sector. This division, which all the way through to the fall of 2007 dominated the front pages of the global media as well. Dollar im Sturzflug, the dollar in the crash landing, the panic of the American dollar adorning the Economist's front pages. It's not obvious to me what contemporary historians are going to do when the conventional news media of this type disappear, because their cover art does such a favor to us in our teaching mode. These are really a gift in summarizing this moment. This is the moment also famously when Jay-Z could be seen waving wads of Euro notes on his MTV videos, and Gisele Bündchen refused to be paid in dollars for endorsing Pantene. There was a sense that the dollar was going down, and anyone serious with Gisele Bündchen's kind of net worth had to take that kind of risk extremely, extremely seriously. But that is absolutely not what happened. This is the broad index of the dollar's value over the course of the crisis. And of course, in due course, we know as a result of QE, it does slowly slump. And we're now living in the world, the consequences of the recovery from that. But if you look tightly at the dollar in 2008, this is the moment of those headlines. And then look what happens as we hit the actual crisis. The dollar surges against a broad basket of international currencies. If you look at vulnerable emerging markets, like the South Korean won, this is the inverted scale. Obviously, a movement up here means a devaluation of the won. There's a catastrophic devaluation of the South Korean won in the fall of 2008. Now, this is deeply counterintuitive. This is a country running a massive trade surplus with an enormously large government reserve of dollars, and yet in 2008, when the proverbial hits the fan, the dollar's moving up against the won, causing, as we will know now from many of these sorts of situations, enormous pressures on the balance sheets of companies which had engaged in carry trade borrowing on the expectation of won appreciation and cheap borrowing in the United States. The reverse scenario. So what was going wrong? Because clearly America is not experiencing the catastrophic collapse of its financial standing that everyone expected. What is happening is that this is breaking down. So rather than it being the geopolitically charged relationship between China and the United States that stands at the heart of 2008, the crisis that was expected and that Hank Paulson's job was to manage, he was made Treasury Secretary to manage the Sino-American relationship, an old China hand. The zone that was actually melting down was the bit that was private, that was unpolitical, that was geopolitically neutralized and was supposed to have insured itself through derivatives against any possible risk of catastrophe. And another element of this is not just that the focus shifts, but you can see also the weighting shifts. So in the Sino-American story, the emphasis is all on this axis here. But if you look, this is BIS balance sheet data, at the entanglement of international banks, and you're a Martian coming down from up high, and you're looking at the global financial system, and somebody asks you to say what the center of globalization in the early 2000s is, you'd have to say, well, it's probably somewhere in Europe, not a million miles away from where we are this evening. It isn't the Sino-American axis. It's the Euro-American axis, anchored fundamentally on the relationship between the city and London and the Wall Street that goes all the way back to World War I. This is what Ben Bernanke meant when he said that the crisis of 2008 was the worst in global economic history. Because unlike in 1929, it wasn't one lot of people's banks failing bit by bit, or a provincial bank run in the United States which doesn't really reach New York until 1933. This was a simultaneous collapse of, or a threat of a simultaneous collapse in all of the banks in the United States and across most of the rest of the world at the same time. Measured in scale in terms of trillion-dollar balance sheets, and the timeline for this is hours and days, not weeks, months, and years. This is what made 2008 radically different from any other experience in the history of the world economy. And this, to me, is the single most shocking graph. These are gross capital flows as a percentage of world GDP, so these are very big numbers. And you can see here why I find the heart attack metaphor such a vivid one to describe what we're dealing with here. This is not a bout of the flu. This is the flatlining of gross capital flows across the world economy in 2008, 2009. And look again where it's happening. It's not happening between emerging Asia and emerging Europe. It's happening at the core of the system. These are gross capital flows within the advanced economy sector. In other words, this is the implosion of that, the breaking of this fundamental linkage in the global economy here. What was happening is a bank run. It's a bank run triggered by bad news, as all bank runs are, and the conventional story, of course, of 2008 focus on the source of that bad news, which are those nasty mortgages and the derivatives based on them. But that's a story that operates on this side of the bank balance sheet, and it's a story about capitalization and losses on the asset side. And that will, in the end, kill banks, and it will really kill banks which have made bad investments, but it takes time to kill a bank through losses on the asset side. Foreclosure is an agonizingly slow process. The peak of foreclosure in the United States isn't until 2011, 2012. In 2008, hardly anyone had actually lost their home. AIG doesn't have to pay out on a single CDS until the end of 2008. That's not what's doing the damage. What's killing the global banking system is a collapse on this side, on the liabilities side, a bank run. This is the sort of illustration we typically use for teaching basic economics, and it's totally misleading. It's totally misleading with regard to 2008 because of the weighting of the different elements on this side. What it suggests to you is that the average endangered bank in 2008 had a lot of customer deposits. The problem, of course, is that the global banking system by 2007-08 had balance sheets which looked much more like this. Find the deposits, they're down here. This is the insured deposit component. The banks which are fundamentally at risk in 2007-08 have this kind of funding structure. In other words, it's market-based funding. It isn't conventional depositors. It's professional to professional money market managers in dealing with the banks. And when they run lightning quick, and the volumes run at an absolutely massive speed. And we saw this first with Northern Rock, which was a massively wholesale funded bank, whose depositors ran in the end and killed it slowly later, but was basically deprived of short-term funding here. And it's the implosion of short-term interbank funding that we see in that graph of the heart attack of global capital flows in 2008, because that's what makes up the bulk of those transnational transactions, is vast amounts of short-term funding going back and forth across the Atlantic. And that's what makes Korea exposed. Korea does have world-beating exports. Korea does have a gigantic national foreign currency reserve, not as big as Russia's or China's, but nevertheless very considerable. But what Korea also has got is a banking system fundamentally dependent on this kind of funding structure. And all of Korea's banks have carry-traded into dollar funding because it's cheap and because the won is going to appreciate against the dollar, so it looks like a good deal. And as that goes into reverse in 2008, this becomes a self-sustaining panic, as you have to be the first Korean bank to offload your dollar funding, shift out of it, and a scramble ensues as the Korean banks outbid each other to gain dollar funding in a vicious circle that takes them further and further into the mire, forcing a very significant bailout of a banking system in a country with a huge trade surplus and a national currency reserve. And of course, from this crisis, this heart attack in the banking sector, the crisis spirals outwards into the real economy. These are the figures for the American labor market over the winter of 2008-09. These are catastrophic numbers. These are job losses in the US over that winter, running at 800,000 per month. This is a catastrophe, a shock, every way comparable to even the worst moments of 1929 to 1930. I think, most widely cited economic history paper in history, that by Eichengreen and O'Rourke, which benchmarked the Great Depression of 2008, the recession of 2008 against the Great Depression, gives you these numbers here for world industrial production. So you can see here, these are months into the crisis. So three along here is 15 months. That's just slightly more than a year. And you can see that industrial production from the peak of April 2008 is falling every bit as fast in 2008 as it was at the worst moment in 1929. Then, of course, we know what happens next, and that's the next part of my lecture. There is a radical historical discontinuity in this respect as well. Here's world trade, and again you can see that in 2008, world trade is in fact collapsing even faster than it was in 1929. The world sees the great trade collapse of the last months of 2008. It's the biggest single synchronized collapse in trade in all commodities and between all bilateral pairs in the history of trade statistics, bar none. And again, we see the different trajectory that follows. And this, I think, is our difficulty in understanding the radicalism of 2008. Is that it looked like a heart attack of a type that we've never seen before, and then somehow, miraculously, it never actually materializes. That disaster that was prophesied and that looked as though it was unfolding in 2008 never quite materializes. And our problem in thinking about 2008 forever after is, as Barry Eichengreen says, in a sense, we live forever in a kind of hall of mirrors where we never actually see the reality of the shock, because it's overlaid with a series of policy responses which are themselves, as I'm going to show in the next phase of the lecture, spectacular and world historic in their scale. But before I go there, before these are the world numbers, and this is the conventional story that we escaped the Great Depression, let's just put a little nuance on that. It depends very much where you are. I'm not going to say anything about the Eurozone in today's talk. We may get into that into Q&A. So the numbers I'm showing you now are the view of the world in 2009, not the view of the world of 2012, where Greece will show up. If you're wondering why Greece doesn't show up, it's because the data I'm showing you next is 2009. But this is an amazing table which shows you the shock to GDP growth expectations between 2007 and 2009. So it's what people expected 2010 to look like before and after the crisis hit. And the bigger the number here, the larger the negative shock to expectations. And look at the scale of some of these numbers here. Across much of Eastern Europe, and that's a theme we might also come back to, this is an epic shock to growth expectations, an earth-shaking derailment of the growth prospects of many of these countries in that window of the first 18 to 24 months of the crisis. You can see the casualties that we normally talk about, the United States and so on, are way down here. If you look out around the periphery of the world economy, the shock is absolutely massive and every bit comparable with 1929. And as we know from the secular stagnation story, even in the well-protected bits of the world economy, the United States, the United Kingdom, relatively well-protected, we have this fundamental and historically unique, really, until you go back to the interwar period, displacement of the growth curve, which, as the San Francisco Fed calculated last week, is costing every single man, woman, and child in the United States currently, over the last 10 years, $70,000 in lost income. Because though growth does in the end resume, it never actually returns the trend. In the United Kingdom, the deviation is even worse, and if I put the Eurozone up here, it would be an even more depressing picture. So, that's the qualification to the point that though this looked even worse than the Great Depression, it turned out to be substantially moderated and contained. And the next point to make is not only that that's a very qualified success, but that the scale of the measures necessary to prevent that repeat of the Great Depression created circumstances which were themselves historically unprecedented. So here, a brief summation of the total commitment of capital, of asset price support and guarantees around the world in the period immediately after 2008. It's a figure of $6.5 trillion, much of which was never used, but as everyone was saying at the time, it's a question of how big your bazooka is, and the bazooka was very, very big indeed. Unprecedented in the history of capitalism outside wartime, the scale of these interventions. Then, of course, the extraordinary asset purchases by central banks, the story of QE, which we're finally agonizingly moving towards the end of this autumn, with the exception of the Bank of Japan. Here, the monthly and annual purchases. Here, the cumulative effect on the balance sheets of the central banks. But again, these kind of graphs don't really convey how historically radical this kind of action is. So here is the history of the Fed summarized in one graph, and it's a hockey stick. There is no, as it were, Fed balance sheet until we get into the latter half of the 20th century, and then the Fed balance sheet enters astronomic growth over here. And the Fed is a relatively young central bank, so this is a relatively short graph over which to do this. Here's the Bank of England, back to the middle of the 19th century. Now, any historian, economic historian worth their salt will say, twos, you're mucking us around here. These are nominal numbers. You haven't adjusted for GDP and inflation, so let's do that. And that's the graph if you do that. In other words, it reinforces the point that these are policy measures not seen outside wartime. So this is the scale of the US Federal Reserve balance sheet scaled to GDP, so we eliminate the effects of inflation. And what you see is that what the Fed is doing from 2008 onwards only has analogs in periods of total war. We are using the methods of total war to combat a civilian economic crisis. On top of that, and it's not just simply a monetary policy story, there's a major fiscal stimulus effort too. And here the perspective of Britain and Europe is deeply misleading because Britain and Europe are retrograde when it comes to fiscal stimulus and withdraw from it as far as possible insofar as we're talking about discretionary expenditure. But if you look around the world, what's really striking is that other members of the G20 really take up the slack. And the most spectacular of these, of course, is China, which launches an earth-shaking, really thunderous herd kind of program, not just of fiscal stimulus, but of government-directed credit expansion as well, blurring the distinction between public and private, which is foundational for the Keynesian concept of the multiplier, which assumes the distinction between the public and private, which is the entire point of that measure. China just wipes that boundary away in an expansion which, amongst other things, of course, included rolling out health insurance to 800 million people, a kind of humiliating comparison with America's pathetic efforts in the same period. But discretionary fiscal policy, and this is absolutely key, is not the only thing going on. What we really see at this moment, and again, the time horizon has to be large here, is faced with a shock like this, the automatic stabilizers we all knew operated in advanced welfare states with big tax systems kick in on a huge scale. So this is the total volume of public debt across the entire world economy. And you can see, contrary to public choice type arguments, it's not actually expanding rapidly before the crisis. And then the crisis hits, and it leaps by 35%. Again, this is scaled to world GDP, so we're talking serious money here, in the wake of the crisis. Part of that is the discretionary stimulus we just looked at, but the IMF estimates that the other half is the automatic stabiliser. If you want to understand the structural backdrop to the incredible swerve towards austerity in 2010, you have to take these numbers seriously. Well, however you judge the merits of that argument, the backdrop is truly radical. And then we should not ignore the transnational elements of crisis fighting in this period. Crucially, the IMF mounts a spectacular comeback. It's easy to forget now that in the wake of the 1990s crises and scandals over IMF policy, it was a discredited institution struggling really for its legitimacy. And I think its customer, its client list in 2007 consisted of Pakistan and Turkey, and Dominic Strauss-Kahn was busily stripping the macroeconomic analytical capacity out of the IMF to save money in 2007. And then the IMF makes a spectacular comeback. And it's a key part, if you talk to the American actors of the drama, in the effort to extend financial support, and they mean it seriously in this instance, crisis fighting capacity to the periphery where the national fiscal capacity is not there. And of course, this is the build-up to the great decision at the G20 of the spring of 2009, where the resources of the IMF are stacked up like this. The IMF moves from being a mid-century modern actor proportioned to deal with the kind of crisis that we saw in the 70s, 80s and 90s to one with $1 trillion plus borrowing capacity, even without leverage, that was capable of dealing with 21st century crises. This is a step change historically that is aligned with and politically legitimated by its new relationship with the G20 and is a non-trivial historical shift. Crucially, it turns out, it's absolutely vital for the survival of the Eurozone, because without this firepower, the IMF is not a credible backstop for the ESM in the summer of 2010. So that's a really weird inversion of history, where the classic product of Bretton Woods era comes back to save the Eurozone at the behest of the Americans at the beginning of the 21st century, when everyone had, of course, assumed that the great game of the future would be global economic governance. It turns out it's rescuing Europe all over again. And all of this is not, in fact, even the most radical thing that happens. The most radical thing, to my mind, that happens in 2008 happens entirely below the radar. It's not even mentioned at the G20 in London, because it would be a little bit embarrassing. And what it involves is the extension of the capacities of the American Central Bank as a lender of last resort to the entire global banking system. These numbers are, I think, unprecedented in the history of a modern central bank. Thanks to a freedom of information suit by Bloomberg, fought all the way to the Supreme Court, we can actually track day by day the lender of last resort function of a central bank under massive stress. Normally, they keep that data very secret for very obvious reasons, because you don't want stigma attached to the people who are taking the money. Freedom of information gave us access to it several years later, and we can track, I've done it here aggregated for the entire crisis period, but if you're interested in Barclays, you can just go to the Federal Reserve line, and you can see how much liquidity the Fed is pumping into each one of the major banks around the world. It starts, of course, with the American banks, but quite rapidly what the Fed starts doing is pumping that liquidity into banks all over the world. And as you can see down here, I've got all the major European ones down here, and the sums add in a typical bank to about $500 billion. And given their balance sheet size of 1.5 trillion to 2 trillion, that means the Fed over this period is providing them with about 25% of their balance sheet in liquidity at moments of crisis. They don't do it all the time. This is not a bailout. It's all collateralized. But in terms of breaking the spikes, when it's quite difficult to get liquid funding, this is an absolute tonic. And this turns out to be only the beginning, because this is when the Fed can interact with a European bank in New York. When the European bank doesn't have good enough collateral in New York, the Fed has to resort to a different mechanism. And what they do, again in one of these sort of historical cannibalizations, is they find a mechanism that was used during Bretton Woods for managing relationships between central banks, and they update it for the purposes of a new global financial economy, which is private bank-centered. So what they do is initiate the so-called liquidity swap lines central bank to central bank. They're little contracts like this. They look like standard rental agreements. And they evolve the swaps of, in the end, as you'll see in a minute, trillions of dollars are between the central banks, collateralized by each other's currencies. So this is top-quality collateral. It's kind of a cabal of the central banks to valorize each other's currencies as collateral for these exchanges. The scale of this, as Ben Bernanke sheepishly admits in his memoirs, is massive. In the December of 2008, it's the largest single component of the expansion of the Fed's balance sheet. The numbers go up to over $550 billion at any given moment. Astonishingly, on October the 13th, the really key day in the entire bailout story, the Fed uncaps the swap lines. What this means is that the ECB, the Bank of England, the Bank of Japan have an unlimited dollar drawing right on the Fed. As one of the European central bankers quipped, they became effectively the 13th branch of the Fed, the transnational overseas branch, which was the dollar ATM for the global banking system. The total sums are a little bit deceptive because they come in different terms. The crude numbers are around 10 trillion. Once you standardize it to a 28-day term, it comes to closer to 4.5 trillion. That's a massive number. In relation, say, to the churn of the repo market, it's not huge because the repo market churns about 4.5 to 5 trillion every given day before 2008. But again, it's about the spikes. It's about breaking the moments when a key actor in the system cannot, for love or money, or at any rate they can afford to pay, access dollars. And what the Fed is saying is, and circumstances like that, we are a lender of last resort throughout the global banking system. It also has the beauty, from the point of view of Ben Bernanke, of saying, I'm not dealing with some bankrupt European bank, I'm just dealing with their central bank, and don't ask me what they do with it. That's their problem. My relationship is with the central bank. And now, after all of that, you stand back and you have Larry Summers' sobering realization of the fall of 2013 in his secular stagnation speech, where he goes, I don't know whether I'm entirely crazy, but I can't resist this thought. And this is not the kind of modesty you often hear from Larry Summers. But we threw the kitchen sink at this. We did everything. That five-point program I've just described, the largest monetary policy, the largest fiscal policy stimulus, these swap line mechanisms. We built out the IMF, and this is all the growth that we get. That is the shocking realization of the fall of 2013. This is a massive, wrenching dislocation of the norms of what can be expected in the global economy in the 21st century. So again, let me bring you back to the beginning. I'm sitting in an interview and somebody asked me, is this going to happen again anytime soon? When's this going to happen again? Doesn't this happen every 7 to 8 years? And the problem is, where do you start in answering that question? And that's why I wanted to have these half hour to kind of expound on it. So why do people ask this question like that? I started out working at the LSE as a graduate student in the 90s, thinking about the way in which we came to understand the economy. It wasn't a history of ideas PhD, it was about the history of economic statistics. So how we formed empirical ideas about facts about the economy, how we ended up thinking we knew stuff about this thing, which didn't even exist in the 19th century, the economy. And so this, for me, is a kind of return to that kind of question. How is it that people keep asking me this question, which is patently absurd in light of these numbers? And one thing I think that's absolutely crucial is that deep down in most people's understanding of the economy is a model a bit like this, some kind of regular, organic, cycle-type model. And quite informed commentators will say, you know, there is a crisis every 7 to 8 years. Well, of course there's a crisis every 7 to 8 years, but it's not the kind of crisis that we're talking about in 2008. So what happens here? There's a sort of abstraction away from history, from specificity, from the logic of particular dynamics, to a general and naturalistic understanding of economic cycles. But if 2008 had been one of those, it would have been dot-com. And that's really probably doing dot-com an injustice, because it is, after all, the result of one of the largest technological epics in human history. But nevertheless, dot-com was a bubble that burst. In the first round, the losses from dot-com were larger than the first round losses from the real estate bust. But it didn't lead to a financial crisis. Why? Because it wasn't built into, these assets were not held by, banks. They were held by real money investors. So pension funds took a hit. 401ks felt bad. There were lawsuits. People cut their consumption and cut their investment. It slowed the economy down, but it was a bout of the flu, not a heart attack. Why? Because these assets were not on the whole held by banks, highly leveraged, short-term funded entities, which is where you get a heart attack in the global economy. Economists are beginning to think hard about this, and the people who are doing this kind of work are people like Helen Ray, people at the BIS, who are thinking about the financial cycle as having different properties from just the regular business cycle and having a kind of history. And the kind of graphs that they draw, which I like much better, are ones like this. And the crucial thing about it is that though it's a regular graph, it also has the nasty feature of increasing amplitude. So we're on a path to ever greater fluctuation in the financial system. That seems to me a much better story than the one which simply starts from a story of nature. But if you look at American housing, which was at the heart of the entire system, neither of these images will really do. Because these are the values of American housing, measured by the famous Shiller Housing Index. And this is the history of America back to the Civil War. And look at the story it tells you. There may be some kind of fluctuation in this. And if you were small-minded and wanted to focus on this bit, you could get yourself some kind of natural curve. But look at this story. There's a discontinuous shock down here into the interwar period. Then there's fluctuations which make you feel happy with your business cycle story. But what we're dealing with is this almighty spike here, which is just off the charts. It doesn't fit into any simple kind of naturalistic history of cyclical behavior. Now, you might say American housing, you know, that's a kind of micro story. Well, American housing real estate probably accounts for between 7 and 10% of all marketable assets in the entire world. That's a $7 trillion fluctuation you're seeing here. So this is a globally significant freakout in the American real estate market from the early 2000s. And it matches, not surprisingly, this graph, which is another version of that global gross flows of finance story, which has a similar kind of Anthropocene hockey stack kind of quality to it, with very little action here, a huge surge, and then the collapse. So, when you're asking the question, will it happen again? My question back to you is, what model of the economy do you have? Do you have this kind of thing? And are you asking about one of those kind of crises? In which case, I'll confidently predict that America will experience a recession in the next 2 years. And there's a whole amount of money all over the world riding on that bet. And I feel quite happy making it, because it's that kind of a story. If you ask me, did financialization and neoliberalism totally change the game in the 1970s, I'll say yes, and you see it in these amplitudes. And then when you actually ask me to tell you a story about 2008 specifically, and whether I think anything like that will occur again, I'd refer you to this graph here, which has a discontinuous logic, which makes me as a historian feel really good and me as an economist feel really squeamish. Because this is the sort of thing that historians specialize in, this kind of discontinuity, this kind of ruptured timeline, which really doesn't accord with any simple story, I think, of continuity. Let me wrap things up. So these will be three narratives. This will be the natural cycle. This will be the increasingly dangerous cycle. And this will be a singularity. Again, I can't help myself right now, I guess it's just been this summer, thinking about the Anthropocene and the kind of logics we mobilize here. This, to me, these two together are a little bit like the argument when we make, where we say that when the ecosystem warms up, hurricanes are more likely. That kind of logic is the sort of thing, I think, that combines those two charts in a powerful way. And one of course, the deeply subversive things about it is that it robs nature of its innocence. Nature is no longer a source of real stability for our thinking about the world, because we have messed it up to such a spectacular degree. Short series of reflections at the end about where we are now. Let me, in a less metaphysical way, attempt to answer this question as to whether or not there are big risks in the system that might indeed cause a crisis. And let me just look at some stuff which for many of you will be very familiar, and then a kind of narrative twist at the end that was very helpful for me in finishing this long book and finding some way to finish it. One is that I think there's lots of good reasons for thinking that at a technical level, the risks are much less than they were. And one way of thinking about this is this graph here, which is basically the triumphalism of Basel III. We've raised capital, things are better. This one here, I think, is a more interesting graph, and I'll come back to it in just a second in a different variant. This is actually just the transnational volume of international banking, and this is what's called the deglobalization of global finance. We actually see a recession in the volume of transnational cross-border banking in the period since 2009, which probably makes the system, at the margin, a little bit safer. The crucial thing in the Basel story, however, is probably not the capital story. It's the numbers down here. It's the liquidity ratios and the net stable funding ratio at the bottom that have actually been causing all the fuss in the banking politics of the recent period. And those are direct attempts by the regulators to contain the risk of bank runs and their impacts on fragile bank balance sheets. What I think from a historical point of view is the extraordinary shift that we're going through, and it lines up with the story that I began with this evening, is we're moving from a national economy-centered observation of risk in the global economy to this. And this is, on the one hand, just look very mundane thing. It's a spreadsheet, it's a list. But what's striking about it, from the point of view of the history of national economic statistics and thinking about national economies, is what's down the left-hand side. Because this isn't Germany, Italy, France, the United States, South Korea, Russia. This is the list of G-SIBs. This is a globally monitored list of private banking entities ranked in terms of their riskiness for the world economy by international agencies. If you look at things like the IMF Stability Report, Financial Stability Report, it now has entire sections devoted to calling out individual banks on their riskiness. From the point of view of the political economy of government, this poses really very fundamental questions about how we justify economic policy. Concretely, what this has meant is that if there is any de-risking, it has happened, broadly speaking, in the European... Well, if there has been a shrinkage in global finance, that shrinkage has come above all through the shrinking of entities like Deutsche Bank, Paribas, Barclays. It has been a concerted squeeze of European banks, and you see it here in the macroeconomic numbers compiled by the BIS, which has been one of the hubs for thinking about this. But the big question, of course, and again this is courtesy of The Economist, is whether or not, in fact, outside the hub of the global economy, there isn't another crisis coming. And in terms of that story I was telling you early on about economics and nature and so on, one of the reasons I like this is that it treats each one of these potential crises as a separate volume, as a distinct thing, but related to each other. And if you look at that graph of American housing, that's precisely how I think we need to think about this. It won't be the same, and it won't be the repetition of a natural cycle, but we need to be thinking about what the next narrative, what the next volume in this story is. Where are those risks going to be? Well, if you ask somebody from Brazil where the next financial crisis is coming from, they'll tell you it's happened already. Right? One of the weird conceptions of this version of events is that it says 2015 question mark, whereas the largest recession in Brazilian history actually already started in 2014. If you ask the same of commodity producers, the crisis already started there. What hasn't happened so far is an aggregation of the various emerging market crises that have been going on. And there is only one emerging market, quote unquote, that could really do that job of aggregating it all, and that is, of course, China. And these are data from which I couldn't possibly have incorporated into the book, because they came from a brilliant Bank of England analysis this summer, which shows the scale of the build-up of the various debt booms that we've been talking about in relation to each other. So this is sort of in percent of GDP, so it gives you really no idea of how big these are. That's the Danish financial crisis, and this is the Chinese one. So Denmark and China on the same scale. This is the magic of GDP. It makes things comparable that are really radically different from each other. You see the story, however, a huge surge in Chinese credit on the scale of anything that we saw before 2008. Here might be another discontinuity. Here might be another singularity. Why does this matter to the Bank of England? Well, these graphs really help with that. This goes back to the very beginning of today's talk. These are two different ways of looking at the world. One trade, one finance. This is what the Americans used to predict a crisis which didn't happen. This is the map which actually shows you where the crisis did happen in 2008 and might happen in future. A trade-based view of the world puts China at the absolute center. A banking view of the world still puts the United States, the UK, and Europe at the absolute center. But what the Bank of England was picking out is this connection here. If anyone has a deep banking-based interconnection with China, it's the United Kingdom. The City of London is the hub for that risk. And the Bank of England is too polite to say it, but on the basis of these new macroprudential BIS-related data, we can in fact name names. I don't think there's really much question about where it lies. Here is the United Kingdom bank exposure relative to other major economies to China. The City of London would be the next domino to fall on the basis of this data in case of a Chinese meltdown. And what would be the domino that would go down? Well, you only need to look at these kind of assessments which the IMF now publishes. It's incredibly indiscreet stuff. Global entities, global governance entities commenting on individual banks. And the crucial name here is HSBC. There's Deutsche Bank. We all know it's a basket case. But HSBC is the HSBC. And there's a European historian. This is an incredible kind of irony. I never thought I would live to see the day. But here's HSBC. And HSBC, as you can see from this data here, like there's JP Morgan Chase, an overall larger significance rating. But look, cross-jurisdictional activity, HSBC scores out of the park on that indicator. That's because it's a bank built to straddle the West and Asia from its inception. And if you're looking for a specific kind of vehicle for this crisis shock, that's where I would look. So this is my concluding slide. This is the transition that we've gone through. Before 2008, we thought about crises like this. Mao and Uncle Sam facing off against each other over macroeconomic aggregates. I've got a threat weapon, you've got a threat weapon. After 2008, in this new scenario, this is how we think about financial crises and their risks, bank by bank. And that is either sort of an incredible technological improvement, which is how the heroes of macroprudentialism comment on it. It is lamentable in the sense that we've moved from the significance of national economies to the significance of private actors. This, after all, is what critics of globalization have been saying monotonously since the 1970s. Finally, now we have an analytic that allows us to actually identify this and a historical case which forces us to look at this. You could also say that this is incredibly politically explosive, because this, what this allows us to do is to spell out our systemic, in other words, our collective interest in the regulation of these entities. When we call it the systemically important banks, what we're neglecting is communally important banks, socially important banks, significant for everyone in the world important banks. And that's really what the IMF is giving us here, is a ranking of how dangerous these things are and how seriously we need to follow their every waking moment. Because on those may hang the question of whether or not there will, in fact, be some version of a repeat of the crisis. Thank you very much for your attention.
Marvellous, Adam, thank you very much indeed, or as I might say in your other native language, unglaublich, which is about my only word of German. Just a couple of questions.
Shall I come and sit down? Why don't we, should we do this?
Like to, yeah, please. Just a couple of words from me, and as I ask these questions, perhaps members of the audience want to think about questions that that you'd like to ask. So you teed us off with a reference to the Eurozone. A question I have after reading your book is, What lessons do you think were learnt in Germany? The German perspective is clear. I think once or twice you quote Chancellor Merkel as making a moralistic statement at the G20 meetings and such. What lessons have the Germans learnt, and are they the right ones?
So thank you for the question, and it's a key one. And one that particularly sort of bites on me, because I was determined. I grew up in Germany. I have a British passport. I sound English, but all of my essential reference points are Bessie. I'm a West German. And I was determined not to write an anti-German diatribe. And I'm particularly concerned about that, because I think we're actually at quite a delicate moment. And we see in Trump, as it were, the characteristically crude expression of this, quite severe anti-German sentiment amongst a large part, not just of the general public. In fact, what's new about this is that it's quite deeply entrenched in, if you like, that supposed elite who are supposed to be the cosmopolitans and so on. So I was very determined to write an understanding history of the Germans. The Germans have this expression of Putin-Versteher, somebody who understands Putin a little too well. And I definitely wanted to position myself as a sort of Schäuble-Versteher. I wanted to be somebody who could understand what Schäuble was about, predict him, make him intelligible to people. And what you see in Germany from the very beginning of this crisis are two or three different responses which are highly significant for then the Eurozone crisis. One, and we have to be clear about this, is denialism. They don't want to imagine that this financial crisis has got anything to do with them, despite the fact that their Landesbank and their small communal banks are amongst the very first to fail, despite the fact that you can see from the Fed's balance sheet that Deutsche, Commerz and Dresdner are totally on the hook for the liquidity, all the liquidity that they can get. Despite the fact that we know, therefore, that Germany was really up to its neck. If you take an American community like Cleveland, Cleveland was basically foreclosed on by Deutsche Bank, especially the African-American communities there. Germany is in, and there's a denialism about this. Then I think the second impulse on the German side is to resist collective European solutions. Now, that can look like a selfish nationalism, and I think there's an element of it there. And they are very committed to a kind of moral hazard logic, which says that if you bail people out, it helps. You know, it helps to incentivize bad behavior. But what's very important to understand is the context against which they do that, which is that they apply that same logic to themselves internally. it's very important to emphasize that Greece is, you know, a fraction of the size of North Rhine-Westphalia, or the fraction of the size of the economy of Bavaria. And Germany's approach to the problems of fiscal federalism is mapped initially onto their problem, their approach to dealing with the fiscal aftermath of German unification. And this is what pushes them from 2005 onwards to an incredibly complex process of federal constitutional reform, which culminates in the debt break of 2009, which is then their model for rolling this out. And that, in turn, is anchored in what the Germans think of as the common sense of globalism of the 1990s. So I see the Germans as the last hangover of third wayism, the Schröder-Blair-Clinton axis. I think of Wolfgang Schäuble as essentially a Rubinite, a long-term orientated fiscal strategist trying to devise a solution for an aging society that needs to export capital. You can tell this story really, you know, significantly. What this, however, prevents is a creative, a discretionary, radical response to the crisis. There's so many different facets to this. And one thing is that they don't have at their disposal the rhetoric that came so easily to people like Tim Geithner, which is how you license discretionary government action is fundamentally by thinking in terms of emergencies. And if you're an American policymaker in this period, you think in terms of military emergencies. And that is just not a language that's accessible to somebody like Schäuble. Schäuble thinks in terms of rules and the building of rules, not because he's a compulsively legalistic German, though he may be that, but because they have experienced in the 1990s the huge shocking effects of some incredibly discretionary behavior by Helmut Kohl in the early 1990s, which made Germany look like a very ordinary fiscal entity indeed. Just to wrap this very long answer up, one further element of this story is the failure of constitutional design in Europe. Right? So this is a further element of this story. There's obviously a huge pressure in 2008 to move towards some sort of collective European solution. Lagarde is sort of shoved out by Sarkozy to make kind of suggestions in this direction and promptly shot down by the Germans. Why are they doing this? Again, you can adduce really selfish motives. They think their banks might be more robust. They don't want to be on the hook for Ireland. But part of the reason they don't want to be on the hook for Ireland is the constitutional politics of Europe at this moment, which go back to the failed constitution of 2005, which was not shot down by the Germans. They were in for building a European, more consolidated state. It was shot down by the French and the Dutch. Then Merkel, in her first exposure to grand European diplomacy, and the German Foreign Office is working flat out, stitches together the Lisbon Treaty, and what happens? The Irish turn it down in a referendum. And then they know that there's a suit running through the German Constitutional Court, which will result in the summer of 2009 in the Lisbon Urteil, which entrenches a strongly sovereigntist, democratically legitimated sovereigntist conception of EU politics. So the absolutely last thing that Merkel is going to do in the fall of 2008 is advocate a huge accretion of financial power to the European Commission for the purpose of saving the Irish. This is not on the agenda at that moment. What she's trying to figure out is how on earth you do Europe governance on the basis of the Lisbon principles. And that coincidence is hugely underestimated, I think, in thinking about what happens next in the Eurozone and giving the German position a logic which is not reducible to some sort of knee-jerk, well, either a sort of selfish logic or a kind of knee-jerk conservatism. There are real principles and questions of large-scale governance at stake here.
Another fascinating insight. Thank you. Questions, please. We have some microphones, and remember we're being recorded, so could you wait until you get a microphone, and then I'll ask. Can we start with someone upstairs, please? Down at the front, please, on the extreme right.
Are we going to bundle?
Yeah, I'll do two or three, and then we'll go from there. And could you keep your questions, sir, short and to the point, if possible, please?
Yep.
And perhaps, if you have an affiliation that's relevant, introduce yourself as well.
Mike Howell from Cross Border Capital. Adam, can I ask you a question about China in 2008?
Yeah.
Because in early 2008, the People's Bank hit the brakes.
Yeah.
Chinese corporations and banks became big borrowers in the Eurodollar markets just at a critical time. But as your slide said, the US Fed was not a lender of last resort to any major Chinese bank.
Yeah.
And certainly it was not. It didn't involve China in any swap lines.
Yeah.
Now, my question is, why do you think that was, and will it happen again?
Great.
At the back, in the middle.
Steve Shearer from City University. looking at the future prognosis you're making, interested if you comment on the politics of the central bank intervention, because clearly not only didn't they reveal this, the main reason they didn't reveal it, the Fed intervention, was the fear that Congress might not be very happy. So the question really is all this global intervention, the IMF, central banks, and some of the other actions, really don't seem to have been underpinned by a kind of democratic legitimacy. They were done as an emergency, but they weren't really part of the normal political process. So the question really is, in the future, can we rely on having someone as smart as Bernanke to take these sort of extraordinary actions if something similar in a different place happens?
That's great. Can I? They're such good questions, and I can segue them together really neatly. So the element of, I mean, I'm so committed in the narrative that I've got to downplaying China's role in 07, 08 that I underrate the moment that you're talking about, which I think is very interesting, because the Chinese are putting their foot on the brake. They think that their economy is overheating quite badly, and they're trying to backpedal. They're also consolidating their ministries. They're really trying a first consolidation effort at that moment. The answer, though, specifically to your question, is that China, if it were to be short of dollars, has the national reserves sufficient to backstop its banking system, however large the borrowing would have been. Even by 2015, we don't think, I think, that the dollar exposure of the Chinese private sector is more than about maybe $1.5 trillion, and the Chinese would have that in reserves and do burn them, as Brad Setzer has shown in 2015. That altogether is an interesting lesson of 2008, which is that the supposed atavistic behavior of emerging market central banks who built up these huge currency reserves because they were self-insuring themselves against the risk of having their sovereignty infringed as they'd experienced in the late 1990s, that kind of Martin Wolf narrative, turned out to be reasonably functional in the crisis, especially if you weren't first in line for a swap line, which the Chinese weren't even considered for. By contrast, the ECB and the Bank of England, you can do a really great straw poll of very well-informed economists as to how large the dollar reserves of the ECB were in 2008. The vast majority of people don't even have an intuition. We all have a pretty good idea of how big the Chinese ones were, but the ECB, the Bank of England has $10 billion. It's like virtually none, because they just assume as sophisticated central banks they'll be able to get them in markets through swaps of various types. None of that's available, and that's precisely the embarrassment of 08, is that robust emerging market central banks like the Russians, for instance, can burn through a considerable part of their reserves, propping up their national banking systems, and they're actually adequate to the task of doing that, even in the face of, from the Russian case, of course, American hostility in 2008. What's really striking about 2015, when the Chinese situation is far more serious and the dollar exposure of the Chinese corporates has gone well beyond the point of 2008, is that the Chinese are in a much more difficult predicament. And this goes to the question at the back here. This is happening at exactly the same moment that Janet Yellen has got to consider the question of whether she goes from standstill at zero interest rates to slowly beginning the taper in the United States. And for me, I think one of the truly kind of world historic moments of the recent period is the decision by the Fed in September 2015 not to raise interest rates. And they decide not to raise interest rates, and she goes before the cameras of the world's press, and she says China, I think, 8 times, and global conditions 12 times. And what this is indicating is clearly in the signaling messaging system of the Fed is they want the global markets to understand that China is inside the decision-making loop of the Fed. The conditions in China are crucially significant to the Fed for two reasons. The impact on American markets of a downturn in China is absolutely spectacular, so much so, and China's so big, that there's no need for the Fed to tighten because credit conditions are tightening as a result of the collapse of confidence in the Chinese side. So both at the level of, as it were, interdependence and functional scale of the Chinese economy, there's just no need for the Fed to act. And that then goes directly to your question. That's a pretty highly evolved state of indirect cooperation between the Chinese and the Fed. And the Chinese at this point are tactless enough to go to the IMF meeting. It's fantastic. We've got the Americans by the short and curlies. They don't dare to tighten without us. We think this is great. This is the responsibility of a global currency like the dollar, which, of course, the Fed would much rather they didn't say, even if it was true. And it's a really striking, I think, instance of how that kind of tacit cooperation is crucial. And if it, of course, begs the question of whether one could imagine anything even remotely like that under current circumstances, where you have a rogue elephant president who only a couple of weeks ago was tweeting out that this collapse in the Shanghai Stock Exchange was a sign of his victory in the trade war. I mean, that's the antithesis of the kind of sophisticated interaction that you could get. When I pitched this story to various Fed insiders, they said, Adam, Janet Yellen, yes, and she was a fantastic and greatly underrated chair, but the other person you've got to figure into the equation here is Stanley Fischer. And the fascinating thing about Stanley Fischer is he is an ex-emerging market central banker because he used to run Israel's central bank. So by way of that, they were, if you like, even at the personnel level. This is the most Davos or Jackson Hole conception of cooperation you could possibly imagine. You could incorporate a series of key emerging market central bankers into the decision-making loop of the Fed because they share nationality, they have dual passports. So I always thought that the next one in line was clearly going to be Rajan because he was one of the greatest critics of the Fed during the taper tantrum, and he's a fully paid-up member of the American establishment, a Booth professor. You could easily slip him in, and then you would, as it were, constitute a world historic actor at the elite level. I mean, this is nonsense, and it completely exposes the force of your question is, where's the democratic legitimacy for that? Are you telling me you're going to put a bunch of people who are dual nationals in control of America's national monetary policy because it needed for the stability of the global financial system? I mean, how long will it be before we get a rogue Republican going after that? And there was that astonishing moment in early 2017 when Republicans in Congress sent a missive round to the Fed saying, cease and desist all contact with foreign nationals and foreign agencies until the personnel in the key administrative bodies have been replaced by people who have the interests of the American nation fundamentally at heart. I mean, as a historian of Nazi Germany, this is deeply reminiscent of the Machtergreifung moment, where you deny the patriotism of everyone came before and want to cap off. We are in a moment where that kind of risk is there, and if you talk to Fed people about what happened in 08-09, one of them said to me it was like we had a guardian angel on Capitol Hill. There were clearly people who understood, and we had justifications, let's be clear. They're not doing a bailout, it's all collateralized, there's no risk, they get paid, it's all hunky-dory, and they're doing it not out of some grandiose ambition to stabilize the world economy, but because of the risk of a fire sale on behalf of these huge European banks unless they do it. So they have the defensive arguments already, but one can't help thinking that they protest a little much in saying that this was just a matter of technicality.
Wow. Good stuff. Up here. Anyone this section? Behind you, Mr. Mike Friend, there we go.
Thank you, Chairman. My name is Phil Wyatt. I have a trade union.
I'm sorry, sir. Who are you? And could you use the mic, please?
Okay. My name is Phil Wyatt. I have a trade union background. Yep. I think I heard you use the word austerity once only.
Yeah.
Is austerity not a big part of this story?
Great question. Great question. And then just to the front, please, a little here. That's it. Thank you.
Hi. I'm Sagar Agrawal from Bryan College. And to what extent have the Europeans paid for the Nixon shock, for example, in the European crisis, for example, liberties taken under Bretton Woods?
Sorry, I find it hard to hear you. Can you speak up?
I'm asking, to what extent have Europeans paid, for example, in the Euro crisis, for the Nixon shock, for example?
The breakup of the breakup of Bretton Woods.
Yeah.
That's very, these are interesting.
Hold on a second. So, one at the back here. Gold standard?
I think so. Bretton Woods, Nixon shock.
My name is Ijaz Uddin.
Could you hold the mic up, please?
Close to the mouth. Yeah.
My name is Ijaz Uddin. I'm a 16-year-old student. And I'm a novice regarding the financial crisis, but I kind of wanted to get to the fundamentals of it. Quite a lot of people put the blame on banks being the central, obviously, regarding the subprime mortgages, et cetera. However, can it be argued that the Federal Reserve, back in 2004 under Alan Greenspan, him putting interest rates at 1%, that kind of almost caused the trigger in kind of black banks exploiting just ordinary people and putting these subprime mortgages and kind of causing the catastrophe of 2008.
Excellent. Like that kind of novice. Good place to start is what I'd say. No, that's a really interesting argument. It's sort of irresolvably, I think, political. And it has a huge political resonance at the current moment because one of the kind of less bonkers components of the Republican Party, after all, really has always quite liked the idea of having Taylor, of the Taylor rule, as the central bank boss. And he is the economist who's been most vigorously critical of Greenspan, because he doesn't think that interest rates were set at stable levels in the early 2000s. And the element of truth in that, I think, is that there was an incredible kind of foretaste of what was going to happen, or rather the build-up of credit that we saw in the housing market that drove that spike was quite deliberately engineered by Alan Greenspan, I think, in response to the dot-com collapse. And what you do is you drop interest rates. And the aim of the game was to get the mortgage business going and to get it going on a huge scale. And it's, when you think about the history of mortgages and the way that they work, it's really an interesting phenomenon, because say if you're German or Spanish, the Anglo-American mortgage system just strikes you as insane. Because you go into a mortgage over a 30-year period, basically with the open-ended right to remortgage every time interest rates fall below your current level. So as the lender, you take the risk of lending over 30 years at an interest rate, and then whenever the market turns against you as a lender, all your borrowers can refinance at lower interest rates. And the advantage of that, of course, is it releases purchasing power and generates a huge boom in the mortgage industry, which is what Greenspan was quite deliberately inciting in the early 2000s. What they didn't reckon on was the financial innovation going on in that sector. They were thinking like macroeconomists. They looked at this and thought, this is exactly the stimulus we need. You've got to remember 9/11 and dot-com together, huge shocks to American society. What they didn't figure was that this would shift the balance between Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, who were doing regular old American mortgages, and the hyped-up private sector business that was going to do the subprime. And they really kick into full speed in 2004. So there is indeed a real trigger function from that interest rate decision, not just because it was macroeconomically imbalanced, but because it induced and helped to speed up rates of financial innovation, which then produced this toxicity. And then, of course, the Fed is very slow to raise after that. It goes incrementally bit by bit, the opposite of shock and awe. And, of course, this is then the origin of the Bernanke story, that they couldn't get interest rates to go up at the long end because there's the global savings glut. What they're not figuring on is not so much the global savings glut as just the gigantic credit creation capacity of this private sector beast that they'd unleashed. So that's a very interesting part of the story, and it's Bernanke read it and Greenspan read it, and their critics tend to read it as a story about macroeconomic imbalance, whereas I think it's much more interestingly read in terms of these macroprudential questions of what kind of financial innovations are opened the door to by this kind of interest rate decision. So now let me wind back to these other questions. Bretton Woods and the dollar. We are all living in a world shaped by the dollar. That to me is one of the messages of this kind of story, is that, you know, much as Heiko Maas, the German foreign minister, may like to imagine a world in which we save ourselves from the capriciousness of the American president by creating a European monetary fund and having a European payment system independent of the dollar, they are kidding themselves if they think that that kind of initiative any time in the medium term, unless Germany is going to finally step up into the trillion-dollar league of actually doing things. But barring that very unlikely contingency, the world is driven by global funding flows, and the availability, cheapness, and the backstop the Fed provides to the global dollar system gives it a resilience that just means that talk of Bretton Woods 2, Bretton Woods 3 kind of intergovernmental bargains is irrelevant to the way in which the global monetary system operates. It's one of the things I think the left totally fails to realize in 08-09. The sort of Stiglitz plans for a new global currency are just beside the point of the provision of credit and liquidity to the global system, which relies on private sector balance sheets. So that's, I think, the real heart of this. We are trapped on the dollar by virtue of its incredible efficiency within the private sector. But that is a story that doesn't go back to the Nixon shock. It goes back to the origins of the euro-dollar market in the 50s and 60s, which are themselves, as it were, a more or less deliberately articulated free financial zone between the US Treasury, Wall Street, and the City of London and the UK Treasury, which made a space outside Bretton Woods, which blew Bretton Woods up. Because much as Nixon pulls the trigger, the gun has to be loaded, and it's the euro-dollar system that loads up the gun that blows the Bretton Woods system up. Austerity. Austerity didn't feature in this talk only because I was focused so sharply on 08-09. Where's the gentleman that asked it there? And this was a talk about what was happening in 08, 09. And if you look at that moment, and this is crucial to setting up the austerity episode that comes after it, is this blowout in public finance, part of it deliberate by, say, the Obama administration, and part of it as a result of the automatic stabilizers, which just simply expand the deficit in a wholly helpful and stabilizing way, given a crisis like this. And so in 08, 09, there's no austerity happening. There's a huge expansion of deficits, the biggest one since World War II. It's absolutely spectacular. And without that, the economic consequences would have been extremely severe. But it's that which then sets up, in combination with the Greek episode, which is politically manipulated within the Eurozone to turn, as it were, the entire narrative of the Eurozone, and then deliberate political entrepreneurship by key actors, by politicians, by newspapers, and by members of the economics profession like Reinhardt and Rogoff, who ride in on this story and announce that once you hit the 90% threshold, you go over a cliff towards, a cliff towards a slippery slope. It's kind of a mixed set of metaphors. and that something has to be done and has to be done urgently. And it's an incredible instance of, one moment of learning from history, as Ben Bernanke does, in this open-ended commitment to prevent deflation, which is at the core, counterintuitively, of his monetarism, because that's what monetarism was ultimately originally about, was preventing deflation. And he learned this from Milton Friedman and Alice Schwartz, that you must not allow deflation. This is the origin of American monetarism. That's a learning from history which sees us through 08-09. And then a very different type of learning from history comes to dominate the scene in 2010, which is all about the austerity panic. And from then on in, that you could in fact cite as another historical, historically unique quality. Never before in the history, certainly not since World War II, in the history of democratic capitalism, has the tap, the fiscal tap, been turned off as savagely as it was from 2010 through to about 2013. And you see this everywhere. And for all of the sort of bun fight between the Germans and the Americans, the Americans are tightening faster than the Germans, in part involuntarily because of the shit show in Congress, but in part because people like Orshak in the Obama administration, the true believing Rubinites from the 90s who believe this is a key part of centrist progressive politics.
Another LSE graduate.
Yeah, to stabilize the fiscal balance for a whole variety of rather good reasons, intergenerational equity, all that kind of thing. So two very different types of learning from history back to back with completely different political valence.
Excellent. Down here at the front, please. And then after that, the gentleman with the moustache at the back. And then the gentleman there, please. Sir, you're on.
Thank you very much for that. My name's Jack Schenker, and I'm a journalist, and I'm interested in your thoughts on the lived experience of the crisis, and in particular the post-crisis world in Britain and beyond. I mean, it feels to me like for young people, a social compact with the prevailing political economy has been broken. Mm. We've had the longest, decline in real incomes here in recorded economic history. We are the first generation in over a century that's going to end up poorer than our parents. And so many elements of what you might think of as the kind of Thatcherite property-owning dream have been destroyed in the last 10 years. In-work poverty is up. Yep. The notion that a stable job is going to guarantee your prosperity is gone. Yep. Partly because of QE, housing is unaffordable. Yep. And I think also a sort of ethical claim to capitalism for many young people rings hollow now. And so I guess the question is, in light of that, rather than when is the next economic crisis, how do you think about the kind of political crisis we're living through right
now? Ongoing crisis right now.
Great one, thank you. At the back.
if memory serves me correctly, it was Her Majesty the Queen. If memory serves me correctly, it was Her Majesty the Queen, whose knowledge of horse flesh is greater than economic history, who inquired of some hundred and something economists, did nobody see it coming? No. Does Adam agree that was a perceptive question and remains a perceptive question?
Yeah, and again, that happened here at the London School of Economics. God bless her.
You were embarrassed by the Queen.
Now, sir, you've got to ask a question which I can make a reference to the London School of Economics. You're on. And can you tell us who you are, please?
Yeah, Mike Black, certainly LSE.
Hey!
And My question may be a little bit unfair because I'm not sure we've actually covered it in your book, but given the volatility of the banking system that you've portrayed, would you suggest that cryptocurrency is a panacea?
Yeah.
Thank you.
I'll take crypto first because it's so delicious. I mean, I think of, and this goes back to the Bretton Woods point, actually, I think of cryptocurrency as the sort of the misbegotten child of panic about fiat currency and fossil fuel civilization. I mean, it's this nightmarish vision in which people who are profoundly uncomfortable with the elementary fact that currency is a social creation, whose value is basically licensed by collective confidence, and are profoundly uncomfortable with that because they're profoundly uncomfortable with politics fundamentally, and I think actually democracy, indulge themselves at the expense of a horrendous consumption of electricity generated by some of the dirtiest power stations in the world in the north of China. And that is what we're living through. It's a kind of, you couldn't invent a better image of apocalypse in the early 21st century than that. They're burning a hole through our environmental future in pursuit of a currency which is beyond the control of democratically elected governments. And that's a kind of toxic coda to our current moment. Yes, the generational question. I mean, I've been out of the UK for a while, and I hear tell of this anger. It's been said that I don't feel it powerfully enough, and that's probably fair, because I'm not here, and I haven't been exposed to it in teaching students, for instance, and it hasn't been quite the same, perhaps not surprisingly, the kind of Americans I've been teaching for the last 9 or 10 years. Who were, in fact, when I first started teaching this, many of the kids that were in the classes had siblings whose start into the labour market had been aborted, who had had to rethink their plans quite fundamentally. And this is kids at Yale, so. But obviously, I think in the United States, that what you're saying is profoundly true, above all, of the black community in the United States, who have unemployment rates amongst black young men in the mid-40s by the early 2009, even in cities like New York. And that's on top of criminalization and all the other familiar processes of massive social exclusion and violence that they suffer. Since then, it has to be said, in the United States, of course, the labor market has recovered rather better, at least the measured stuff, though there's all these stories about these lazy young men going to play video games in the basements of their parents' houses, who are opting out in their own way. But the catastrophe is clearly in places like Spain and Italy, where it's not even your income prospects which are damaged, which is true in the United Kingdom, but they just simply have lost any access to the labour market. And when I try and bring this home to audiences in the United States, I say to them, and this really has to be a story about Spain, because Greece is, with all the will in the world, it's tiny. Ireland is tiny. Italy and Spain are not. And the European unemployment crisis is fundamentally a Spanish unemployment crisis. They account for the vast majority of the increase. And when I try and explain this to Americans, I say that the Spanish economy is roughly the size of Texas. And imagine if the State of the Union address had to include the fact that there was 45% youth unemployment in the state of Texas, not in ghettos, not amongst disadvantaged minorities, but across every single young person in that state. Imagine the kind of political upheaval that would be going on in the United States if that was true. And that's what Europe is living with right now. And then we ask ourselves why the EU is in trouble, and I ask that question as somebody who's existentially committed to that project. That I couldn't agree with you more. I mean, it is the most severe betrayal, and I find it just it stretches credulity that the ECB does not have have an employment mandate. And the Fed, at least Ben Bernanke, and one has to say, give the guy credit, in announcing QE2, commits the Fed to keeping the monetary taps open, and he would rather see fiscal action, but if there's nothing else going on, he is going to keep the monetary taps open until American unemployment hits 6%. This is 1960s-style monetary Keynesianism, you like. He doesn't have a Phillips curve. He doesn't know quite what it looks like, but he is not raising interest rates until that unemployment target is met. Now, that's a kind of remarkable policy initiative, which I think is fundamentally supportive of legitimacy, though it doesn't buy you much in the American case. And it's just, I especially when you compare this to, say, the Chinese regime, which is obviously authoritarian and repressive in every extent, but it understands the basic math of legitimacy, namely unemployment is a problem. And you have to do something about it urgently if it's visibly going up. And the EU seems to live in this world in which that trade-off does not exist. I mean, it's to me, you can hear the tone in my voice. Yes, economists. They didn't see the crisis coming. No, it's a little unfair, and the ones that I have...
Interesting, Adam, that you use the pronoun they didn't see it coming.
Yeah, I'm not...
Think of yourself as a historian.
Yeah, I did econ in Cambridge a long time ago in the 80s, and I left that profession with clear intent, and I knew why I was leaving, though I learned an enormous amount from reading economists, and I spent my time in the last couple of years doing precious little else. I don't belong to that community. But that's part of my own personal, you have to be a particular type of subjectivity to pursue the profession.
I mean, having asked the question, I feel I've embarrassed the audience response, I've embarrassed our speakers. I'll make the point. I mean, I think it's very interesting that the LSE, I've mentioned it again, is one of the only universities in the UK that has an economic history department. One of the things I found interesting from reading Adam's book is the resistance of economists to an historical perspective. So I think we heard Adam say it when he was speaking as an economist, as an historian. And I think one of the value of the book is that historical perspective. And one of my questions, got one to answer, but one of my questions for you is, how do economists respond to this kind of analysis? What kind of engagement or lack of engagement do you get from the economics department at Columbia or economists elsewhere?
So far, so good. I think probably one of the happier moments of my recent professional career was to get a lovely tweet from Shin from the BIS, whose work I find utterly transformative of our understanding of the modern world. I mean, Shin, Borio, Desayat, Adrian, the entire macrofinance people have finally made good on our understanding of globalization as driven by corporate actors, and they're producing data like this. Now, as somebody of leftist inclinations, I'm going, thank you very much. If we'd had this kind of intellectual ammunition, I mean, my impatience tends to be on the whole with the left wing of political economy, which to my mind has not rapidly enough assimilated the kind of stuff that those people are doing. So I actually think, that the economics profession in certain key parts did anticipate the crisis. I mean, you can't say that Adrian and Shin's paper or that Rajan's work between 2005 and 2007 isn't clearly pointing to the dynamic. Adrian and Shin have this great analysis of the pro-cyclicality of investment bank balance sheets. So they know exactly how this thing goes. And a lot of learning was done in the late 1990s about currency mismatches as well. And as I started by saying, there were a whole bunch of macroeconomists who were predicting a crisis, just the wrong one. Where there is a real disconnect is at a moment like Jackson Hole in 2005, where we're celebrating Greenspan's exit. So it was a bad moment to make the point. But nevertheless, Rajan goes and makes the kind of argument we were having, this exchange. What about the micro effects of these macro policies? Are the risks building up there? And Summers, in his pomp, summons up all his authority to slap this down. And he's really telling how he does it. He says, this is Luddite. To think like this is to go against the course of progress. It's almost as though you wouldn't fly on airplanes for fear of crashing. So this is an anti-technological, anti-modernist kind of thinking. And there I think you can say not only did they not predict it, but there were people who, whilst they were focusing, that's a Larry Summers image. Summers had a model of crisis in mind. It was the wrong one. But with his other hat on, his Wall Street hat on, he didn't want to hear deep and searching explorations of the risks that might be there in the private sector. So those are the kind of divisions, and what I find fascinating, particularly in the macro-financial literature, is those inhibitions are broken down. I'm not sure that they fully understand the political import of what they're saying, because what this basically means is that targeting the profit of these actors, when we say we're going to ensure financial stability, what we actually mean is we need to ensure that these actors have a substantial amount of profit being generated to ensure their financial robustness. If you look at the stress tests in America, what's really fascinating is all eyes are on the capital question and capital raising in 2009. If they're found to not have enough capital, they're going to have to go to the market and raise capital. If you look inside the stress tests, what you find is they have this other category called other resources, which are reserves. What are reserves formed by? Retained profit, pre-provision net revenue. And so the Fed from 2009 is essentially targeting the pre-provision net revenue of the American private banking system. Now, that really, one should let that sink in. The Fed, as a macroeconomic stability imperative, is targeting their profit rates. So when we say that they have, you know, the advantage of having had the seal of approval from the stress test, we're really understating this. Their profit margins and their rate of profit accumulation has been made the object of interest on the part of Fed policy. Now, that takes you out of the realm of neoliberalism. That takes you out of the realm where you're trying to depoliticize private economic activity. That basically puts them in the realm of regulated utilities, where that kind of talk has been crucial all along, because we need to know that utilities will invest, and so we need to handle, you know, have some kind of agreed profit rates and so on. And that's, of course, not the world that bankers thought they were in the 1980s or 1990s. So there is a huge political door that is opened by these innovations in economics, which I have to yet really engage in a dialogue with these folks, and I hope the book enables that. But that, for me, is really the real question, is what do we make of this kind of data? Because there's all sorts of purposes it could be put to.
Excellent. Time moves on. It's nearly 8 o'clock. I just want you to reflect, where else could you spend a summer evening in London and be as stimulated as you have been for the last hour and 29 minutes? Let me remind you that there's more of this good stuff on the table outside, where you can get copies of Adam's excellent book. Adam is going to stay here and sign books for those that want it. So just let me ask you now to thank Adam for returning home to the London School of Economics.
Well done, Adam. Great job. Very well done. Very, very good job. Good.